Thanks for coming today. Welcome to the Kansas Speedway and the second year of the IndyCar series using 100% fuel-grade ethanol. We're actually not here actually to talk so much about the ethanol component in IndyCar, but more to address all the negative media that you're reading. You know, there's a ton of misinformation floating in the sort of the blogosphere, the internet, you know, on TV and print. And we're here specifically today to talk about ethanol's true impact on corn prices, its true impact on food prices, which is negligible. We're going to talk about some new technology. It's not a debate over food versus fuel. We can actually have food and fuel. And Dave Vandergren and Mike Sebesky are going to talk about some great technology on the way that we have for that. And we're also going to talk about what would happen to gas prices if the ethanol were removed from our fuel supply system. And you'll be surprised to hear what would happen. You'd be paying over $4 a gallon today if we remove the ethanol. So ethanol has a great impact on keeping our gas prices lower than they would be otherwise. So we're going to start off with Toni Nuremberg. She is our new executive director of the Ethanol Promotion and Information Council. Toni?
Thank you, Joanna. Good morning, everyone. Glad you're all here. Well, I think it's fairly obvious that the ethanol industry has been in the press a lot recently. And not being pictured very favorably, which is a shame. It's become the scapegoat to every interest group out there, whether it's the environmentalists, whether it's livestock farmers, or the petroleum industry. And many are blaming ethanol for all of the rising production costs. And we need to really set the record straight on some of those the myths that are out there. Not long ago, ethanol was being embraced for its clean air benefits as an oxygenate, replacing groundwater contaminating MTBE, and has now become what appears to be the punching bag responsible for everything, including rising food prices and global food shortages. It appears that many have ignored the facts of what is a very complex issue, and careful examination of the facts is in order. It really is a shame today, but you know, it's not unlike years in the past where we really do have a worldwide calamity with regard to the need for food. And it's distressing to think that the rising food prices are affecting humanitarian efforts as well as they're impacting us here in the United States. But I think it's really important to point out that we live in a global economy and there are many factors that are leading to these issues. We have drought in Australia, we have population growth, we have growing demand for oil, growing demand for proteins in third world countries, and you know, the war itself, transportation costs, crop acreage shifts. There are just so many factors that are affecting the overall price of food. Here at home, record high fuel prices are definitely driving the issues and are the biggest factor in the high food prices. The cost of transporting the food to the grocery stores is definitely the largest impact. And you look at the other factors that impact the increase of pricing. Everything from advertising, you know, every time they advertise that box of cereal on television, those costs get added into the food prices. And we're all feeling that pinch in the grocery lines. Ethanol is not subtracting from domestic or global food supplies. Ethanol only uses field corn, and in fact, it's only using the kernel part of the corn, and once the ethanol process, or during the ethanol process, at the end, there's a lot of byproduct that is left in addition to the ethanol that's being created. And it's very high protein feedstocks that can be added into the overall food supply. Grain-based ethanol is really fueling a lot of research these days into the technologies, and we're going to talk about it a little bit later, into the issue of cellulosic ethanol. It's really important that we look for other methods for creating ethanol, and the thing, I've only been in this industry now for about 2 months, And the thing that is really intriguing to me is that this industry is not resting on its laurels as to what it's done to date. It's looking for what it can do in the future. And the whole issue of cellulosic ethanol is huge. And we do actually have an operating cellulosic plant in Wyoming now. So it's exciting, and there's a lot to come yet. But most importantly, it is really important that we have a clear and concise message to consumers with regard to ethanol. They're getting an awful lot of misinformation, as Joanna indicated, in the press, on the internet. There's just a lot of really poor information out there. So many surveys have been done, and Americans really want to find a solution to our energy crisis. And they really, really like the idea of something that is American-made, which obviously ethanol is. It's here now. It's something that you can do just as simply by going to the pump and reaching for ethanol when you fuel your car. They really like the idea of that it's creating American jobs. And I think that it's important that the industry truly be represented in the manner in which it should be. When evaluating ethanol, we really want everyone to weigh all of the facts. The alarmist attitudes that we hear in the press are not serving the public well. And if America continues to be dependent on Mideastern oil, we're just continuing down that same path. The blame game does not solve the energy woes. The policy that adheres to the status quo continues to be a failure. Ethanol is one part of the solution. And while we are exposed daily to the political campaigns that are their mantra is change, we believe that we need to heed the call in relation to our energy policy and continue to promote ethanol as the American-made part of the overall solution. Thank you.
Thank you, everybody, for the opportunity to speak here. But one of the things we wanted to also bring to mind is that the biofuels industry has recognized a number of years ago the opportunities that we had with our grain-based crops that we have here in the U.S. to advance the quality of those by removing the things of little value, which is starch and fiber, and concentrating the things of high value, which is protein and amino acids and stuff, to address world food opportunities. In the United States, we are not food short by any means, and in many third world countries, we are not grain-based short. We are not starch short, but we are protein short. And what is the opportunity that we have here? Instead of sending away 56 pounds of what I would call a dilute product, can we send 5 or 6 pounds of a high-quality product that can be used in the food industry? We happen to be rolling technology to do that out in this year. But the issue that we're dealing here with food or fuel is something that has been well orchestrated and well played in the media that it is responsibility of biofuels. And what I did here is I took a chart along, and I don't know if any of you can see this, but this chart represents the last 9 years of world food production, or what they call here whole grain supply worldwide. Now, the blue line here represents the U.S. or the world production, and the magenta line represents the world consumption. If you look at the last 9 years, 7 of those 9 years, the world produced less food than we consumed. Okay? We are currently at over 5% shortfall in our production and our consumption. Now you're saying, what is the biofuels part of this particular graph? Way out here on the left, last year's production of whole grain supply is less than 0.5% is biofuels. So really, what has been our influence in this is absolutely very, very small. And the biofuels industry has taken the grain that we are processing and converting it to a higher value. We are taking out the low-value products, such as the fiber and the starch, and we are left with a high-protein, high-value product that is going today into the feed market. Tomorrow, it will be going into the food market. The biofuels industry is aggressively looking at opportunities and ways that we can continue to meet the global need for food. Kansas, especially Governor Sebelius, has been very involved in these type of projects and products and has done an excellent job, I believe, in setting up this state and this nation to be the leader in advancing food for a lot of other countries. We have been the breadbasket to the world 50 years ago. We have that opportunity to be the breadbasket to the world again, but we will be the breadbasket in a slightly different form. We will be the breadbasket by sending food concentrate supplements, not by sending the raw commodity that has a high freight cost associated with it and a very low value to people in its raw state. And our ability to add value, our ability to address this situation here is something that has been taken seriously, is being taken seriously, is being addressed with, and we believe that the biofuels industry will be able to be a major contributor in reducing overall food short supply. And if you just look at it from a fuel perspective, it has been documented multiple times and in a report that just came out from Merrill Lynch that the fuel ethanol, which represents about 8% of our consumption here in the U.S., if that 8% was missing, they estimate that the cost of gasoline would go up by 15%. Now, if the cost of gasoline went up by 15%, that would be well over 50 cents a gallon. At 50 cents a gallon and 145 billion gallons of consumption in the United States would represent somewhere just under $75 billion that the consumer would be paying today if it wasn't for the biofuels industry. We, as part of biofuels, we, as part of those trying to develop sustainable agriculture, are aggressively and actively working in those arenas to both meet the food need of this country and the fuel need of this country and the food need of third world countries that do not today have the capability to meet their needs. So we look forward to this opportunity. We really embrace this growing industry. We believe that this is the right industry for this country at this time. And as the food prices do increase, it will allow those farmers in other countries to also be profitable in their business. I was in Hungary a year ago. 25% of the land in Hungary is not farmed. Why? Because they cannot make a living. They cannot afford to farm. There is land in South Africa that is not farmed. The world price of grain is U.S. plus freight, because we make the dominant supply. By seeing some higher prices for commodities, we will see some higher growth of those commodities in other countries, and then we will have the opportunity with the U.S. to supply the supplement to those raw grains to make valuable food products for many, many years to come. And we look forward to that as we address both a domestic issue and an opportunity, and we to address a global issue and opportunity. Thank you.
Well, good morning. My name is Mike Sebesky. I'm with Lifeline Foods in St. Joseph, Missouri. Again, I'd like to thank all of you for showing up this morning to listen to what we're trying to tell you about the benefits of fuel ethanol. And my slant on it's going to be slightly different. Lifeline Foods is the first facility in the second generation of ethanol production that focuses on human food in addition to fuel ethanol. Approximately 20% of every kernel that we process at Lifeline Foods finds its way into the human food stream. The rest of the kernel, if you will, is processed into ethanol and other high-value co-products. Dave was talking about high-value protein, the United States being long starch, and subsequently we are converting that into liquid fuel. Our byproduct from our process is that high protein content that the rest of the world is lacking. In addition to the domestic food supply that we manufacture at Lifeline Foods, we are also participating in humanitarian food aid across the globe. We participate in food aid programs that feed the needy in the third world countries that, like Dave said, are short on grain, are short on protein sources, and we are helping sustaining life not only in the U.S., but globally across the entire world. So we have a very unique facility at Lifeline Foods where we're able to maximize the values of the three components in a kernel of corn, those being fiber, starch, and protein. Okay, the starch essentially gets processed into fuel ethanol in addition to human food. The fiber portion of the kernel is combusted to replace natural gas. Okay, this minimizes our carbon footprint as a processing facility. And the oil portion of the kernel, which is the germ, is processed for corn oil, which is a more healthy food oil as compared to other vegetable oils that the consumer is now consuming. So again, our process at Lifeline Foods, like I said before, is the first facility in this next generation of ethanol production to maximize the value of the grains that are processed here in the United States. And again, maximizing the value of fiber, oil, and starch.
Before I open up to questions, I'm going to ask Mike to talk a little bit about being the fuel supplier for this year for all the IndyCars. Mike, can you just tell us a little bit about, why you wanted to be the fuel supplier, and what does it mean to the ethanol industry to have that honor?
Well, it's extremely exciting for Lifeline Foods being, again, the first facility in the second generation of ethanol production. With all the innovation that we have at our facility, it marries up very well with the IRL and the innovation that they have going around the track this afternoon. So it's extremely exciting for us to represent not only the member owners of Lifeline Foods, our immediate community in St. Joseph, Missouri, but also the entire fuel ethanol manufacturing sector in the U.S. So it's a tremendous opportunity for us. We'd love to showcase the virtues of fuel ethanol here on the racetrack, and hope that the people that witness that can also see the virtues of that product in their own automobiles driving around their communities.
Great. And Dave, I was wondering if you could hit on a point for everybody here. It's policy related, but if you look back at the new sort of America's energy policy, it's my understanding that it's actually not designed to wean our country off petroleum-based fuel. So that being said, how quickly can the ethanol industry continue to sort of ramp up to really help address these issues that we're seeing in terms of, competition for oil, and energy independence issues?
That was about 12 questions.
Address them all, Dave.
Well, the ethanol industry is growing at a rapid pace, but the ethanol industry is consuming a product that we have more of than we need. The United States increased production of corn this past year by over 2 billion bushels. That was more than we increased the biofuels industry by quite a bit. Also, we have expanded our exports from this country for grain, and we've expanded that at a very, very high rate. I think we're at record target this year for exporting the most amount of feed grain ever by the United States. So the United States has really stepped up to the plate to help meet those needs, but with the very weak dollar we have, when you're looking at a dollar is worth 75% of what it was just a little over a year ago, they can buy a lot more of our grain. To us, our food may seem high. To them, our food still appears fairly cheap, or at least less expensive than other alternatives. So we are dealing with a year of a lot of things happening with oil prices hitting $120 a barrel. That's sending about $1.4 billion a day out of this country to buy fuel. And the thing to keep in mind, the fuel that we are getting, it's not all coming from the Middle East. I recognize that, but that's not our best favored place to get it. Canada and Mexico are our favorite places to get as much fuel, or at least North America, as much crude oil as we can. But when we take $100 worth of crude oil that we've gotten from the Middle East and we send them our $100, we put that fuel in our car, we drive down the road, everything is gone. The money's gone and the fuel's gone. When we do that same thing with fuel ethanol, at the end of the day, we put it in our car and we drive down the road, the fuel is also gone. We still have the money to do this again and again and again. And that is the fundamental economic difference between biofuels and imported oil. We can continue to repeat the process and repeat the process. Ethanol plants are built by American workers. Ethanol plants are operated by American employees. Ethanol is consumed by the American consumer. It is a truly, completely domestic product that adds value to this country. There is not another industry that I know of out there that can say we 100% use American raw products, American people to create American product that adds value to America and reduces our dependence on those that do not have us on their Christmas card list.
Thank you, Dave. With that, I'm going to open it up for questions.
What we are working on is an evolution of fuel ethanol that continues to remove more of the products. The first stage we did at Lifeline was to separate the germ, the fiber, and what we call endosperm, which is the starch and protein mixed together. The endosperm goes to a snack food company. And we are now on the second phase of that project of removing the corn oil from the germ on site. Currently, that's done for us by another company. But our goal is then to go after the high protein, the concentrated, well-balanced amino acid protein out of the germ. We have done that in the lab. We've done it in the pilot plant. We have not done it on commercial scale yet. Lifeline is the location where we are commercializing each one of these particular products. So we have the protein that's in the germ, and then we also have the protein which is in the endosperm. The endosperm protein is where we believe we're going to have the biggest impact or influence on global protein needs, because that's where the majority of the protein resides.
And would this product then be a protein that could be directly consumed by humans as opposed to being fed to livestock?
That is correct. Lifeline is a food-grade, AIB-certified facility, and those things will be removed from the corn kernel and separated. And what you're really saying is we're taking the leftovers that have the low-value products and we're making fuel. When you look at these cars going around the track today running on fuel from Lifeline, this is fuel from the waste products of the corn kernel after we've taken all the valuable stuff out. And we're running on the leftovers. That is truly is a balance between, you know, getting the valuable food products first and then getting the low value, what I would call more of a feed product, second.
And Tony, if I could ask you one policy question. The Farm Bill deal that just got done Friday apparently reduces the blender's credit for ethanol from 51 to, I think, for 50, reduces it by 6 cents a gallon. Livestock producers that I talk to say it's time to phase out subsidies and support for ethanol production in this country. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I'm going to admit, first of all, that I'm not a policy expert. Greg Krisik is here, and he can address that perhaps better than I can.
And so everyone knows, Greg Krisik is with ICM, but his focus is policy, so he'll be able to talk really more in depth than any of us ever could on subsidies and that type of thing. Thank you, Greg.
For my benefit, could you just repeat the question real quick?
Yeah, my understanding is that the new Farm Bill deal reduces the blender's tax credit for ethanol by 6 cents a gallon. Livestock producers that I've talked to have said it's time to phase out ethanol effectively bid against livestock producers for the available corn supply because of the support that that ethanol gets from the government. Is it time to phase those subsidies out of your budget?
Well, there's probably a couple things to recognize around that program. What you're referring to is called VTEC, Volumetric Ethanol Excise Tax Credit. First of all, because of the positive or the increases in grain prices over the last year, USDA has saved in excess of $7 billion in actual farm support payments, which far outweighs any VTEC credit that the federal government foregoes. It's you don't pay something on your fuel taxes. The other thing to be aware of is really for the last 12 months, with the price inversion of ethanol to unleaded gasoline, ethanol producers do not receive that tax credit or even a portion of that tax credit. So in essence, if it was partially reduced when you're getting zero and it's partially reduced, you're not getting any more than you were getting for the last 12 months. What I think it begs the question of is there a better system? And I should clarify, the tax credit is going to the blenders, to the oil companies today and over the last 12 months. It begs the question, should there be a better way to have that system created going forward? It's my understanding it was reduced. It continues for another 2 years. During that time period, that may be the time period that's the right time to talk about how should that credit work, and maybe there's a way to find a win-win solution where the livestock producers are not as concerned about it. Dave may have a comment to that too, though.
I think one thing to add to that, the ethanol industry has been here for 25 years. I've been involved with it for that long. It's really been about the last 5 years that we have gained some significant traction because of the ability of the American farmer to produce a lot of grain at a low value. But for our industry, our competitor is our customer. They're one and the same. And VTEC was formed to give a 5 cent a gallon credit to our competitor so that he was willing to be our customer. That was an effective tool to keep the industry alive over the last 15 to 20 years. The program is really not as effective as it could be. The consumers are, at the end of the day, consumers pay for everything. And the consumer is paying for this tax credit. The ethanol industry is not receiving it. The petroleum people are receiving and retaining that entire credit.
There is a simple yes, if you look at the BTU content of ethanol versus the BTU content of gasoline, but when you're talking about the blends that we are most consumers work with, and that's E10, I have yet to see a large-scale study that shows any dramatic reduction. To the best that I have seen on the small-scale studies, maybe a percent reduction in your gas mileage, and we frankly see just as many results that actually get better mileage, because not only is there the BTU, but it's and as maybe someone in our company says, it's the work that happens in the engine, the higher octane value of the ethanol. There are blending reasons that the refiners want the ethanol in there. So from a pure theoretical standpoint, you cannot stand by that, because I have not seen the data to show that, especially with 10% or less blends.
If you were going to heat your house with ethanol, it would be extremely expensive because you're thinking of it in BTU, British Thermal Units, heat units. Ethanol is not a heat fuel. It is a power fuel. It is an oxygenate fuel. So when you're taking ethanol and they're blending E10, and even in the flex fuel vehicles that are taking the 20% hit on E85, when they take that vehicle and they run it on E30 or they run it on E20, they are finding mileage improvements because That is where ethanol is of most advantage. So an internal combustion engine is not a heat-generating engine. It is a power-generating engine is the purpose. Ethanol is very effective as a power fuel because it produces less heat and it produces more energy. The radiators in these race cars are significantly smaller running on ethanol than they would be if they were running on gasoline. That's because if you take a gallon of gas, it's about a one-third, one-third, one-third. One-third of the energy goes out the tailpipe, one-third of the energy goes to work, which would be drive shaft, and one-third of the energy goes to the radiator. In ethanol, the percentage that goes out the tailpipe is less, the percentage that goes to the radiator is less, and when the car is designed to run on ethanol, like these race cars are, you see significant mileage opportunities.
Absolutely. I just want to make one comment on the mileage issue, in that there are so many factors as well. I mean, the things that, that Greg and Dave talk about from a scientific, you know, issue, absolutely. But then, you know, if you don't have your tires inflated properly, that can impact your mileage as well. So it, there's a lot of factors, and you know, all of those things need to be considered. Now, from the standpoint of the attacks that we're taking in the media, EPIC, that's one of our primary purposes, is to combat that. And you know, we have a great story to tell, there's no doubt about it. And so we have a network in place now that we are addressing and responding to all of these negative stories on a daily basis. This last week, for example, I feel we finally gained some traction. This last week, where CNN has been pretty brutal over the last few weeks, they actually had the ethanol industry on a program on Friday morning. We had one of our staff, Robert White, spoke on CNBC on Friday afternoon. So the message is starting to be, at least we're being asked now for the other side of the story, and that's what needs to happen. These articles need to be balanced. There is a group that is, we call it the Renewable Fuels Now campaign. It is a group of industry. It isn't just EPIC, it's RFA, it's ACE, it's the corn growers, it's a number of our members, EPIC members, ethanol plants, working together to combat some of this, and also to do some research, to come together and to continue to do research, but on a more national scale. In order to really put the facts behind this, because you're correct in when you say that there are a lot of different studies, and you know they can be spun many different ways. So we really do need to straighten out the facts, and we're working very hard to do that.
Tony, do you believe that it's the oil industry itself that is behind this, what appears to be a coordinated campaign against ethanol, or if anyone would like to comment on that?
I think it is definitely a well-coordinated campaign by a number of groups. It's not just big oil, but certainly yes. You know, when I started with EPIC, like I said, just about 2 months ago, the one thing I said to the board was, you know, the good news is that ethanol is really making an impact in our energy situation, and the bad news is ethanol is really making an impact in our energy. Because now they're paying attention to us and they realize the potential. I believe that firmly, that they're, you know, ethanol does have its place, and as a result, you know, we're coming under attack because we've been successful. But we'll continue to be successful. There's no doubt about it. It is a great story to tell. Go ahead, Don.
Yeah, Tony, I have a number of questions, one of which is, like, it's my understanding, and we talked about this with somebody, I forget who, that a lot of the corn is being bought by the oil companies and resold, and it's strange in the last year that a bushel of corn went from a little over $2 to now over $6, so somebody's making money someplace off of that, which seems kind of strange to me. However, on the positive side, from where I am, I'm from Indiana, Indianapolis area, plants popping up everywhere like weeds. What's so difficult about building refineries if there's such a complaint that there's not enough refineries in America to refine oil? But there are ethanol plants popping up everywhere.
There has not been a new oil refinery permitted and built in the United States since, I think, 1977. In that time frame, or really since the early 1980s, you've now had clearly over 100, 125 ethanol plants that have been built and permitted, which we think also tells the story of the environmental safety and environmental contribution, not only of ethanol as a fuel, but the actual processing facilities as well. So we think that stands on itself, and we will continue to see ethanol plants constructed and permitted because of that. You know, it's fairly difficult to track who is in speculative contracts, but it is not hard, and it's clearly that several investment firms, Wall Street firms, have told their investors that this year the stock market wasn't going to be a very good return for them. But in commodity hedge funds, you could probably expect above 25% return. So that brought money in, and I believe the number, if you look back over about the last 5 or 6 years and compare speculative contracts then to today, that number has increased by like 3 times. There are 3 times as many speculative contracts in the market today as there were in typical history. Today, or I read recently that now today, ethanol in the U.S. has grown to be the equivalent of our 5th largest importing country of oil to us. I think Nigeria is number 5 on the list of countries that we get oil from, and today now ethanol supply is equivalent to that. So we're moving up the ladder, and at the end of the day, you know, where can this evolve to? Ultimately, it's about giving consumers a choice. If you or I want to go somewhere by vehicle, you're going to use almost invariably gasoline. Yet as this evolves and it can evolve towards flexible fuel vehicles, consumers will have more choice and get to make the decision they want on how they buy and use fuel. Dave, do you want to talk about sources?
Well, there's the ethanol industry is a biofuels industry. So that doesn't say you just run corn. You can run any starch-based product, corn, wheat, barley, milo, millet. There's all kinds of products. And then there's your cellulosic side, which is your wood, your switchgrasses, your municipal solid waste, anything we throw away that is a renewable product can be made into a transportation fuel. So corn is the, I always like to say there's a sectional bridge from energy dependence to energy independence. The fuel ethanol industry is just the first section of the bridge. And if we keep that section securely tied to the bank, the other sections connect to it, and we will get from this side of the river to the other side of the river. But if the biofuels industry is unsuccessful, and we go back to the time of when the government is paying farmers not to farm, and we're not utilizing the land that we have, and we're not bringing revenue back to this country in some way, shape, or form, our whole renewable industry will go down the river right along with everything else.
There's another meeting in here coming up, so what I'd like to invite you to do is if you have additional questions, so I believe some of you may have, we'll take it out here into this sort of this open area. And then I'd like to invite everybody at 12:15 to go with us to the Ray Hall Letterman Hospitality Tent to hear Ryan Hunter Ray speak. He's the driver of the number 17 team ethanol car. He's going to talk a little bit about, how excited he is to be driving for the program, how excited he is about ethanol, and kind of give us the ins and outs of what he expects today during the race. So I want to thank everybody, and then we'll just head out here to this main area if you have additional questions. Thank you.